The world is shocked to learn about Boeing's current production quality issues. I'm not surprised, because nothing changed after the two crashes. There was no accountability. Not a single person from Boeing went to jail. Hundreds of people died, and there's been no justice. Unless action is taken and leaders are held accountable, every person stepping aboard a Boeing airplane is at risk.
Former Boeing manager turned whistleblower Ed Pearson, speaking yesterday during a Senate hearing in Washington, he was talking about the two deadly crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia that killed 338 people. That was in 2018 and 2019. Since then, there have been more safety concerns, albeit with no fatalities. The latest incident was in January when a door panel blew off a Boeing 737 MAX jet midair as it was flying from Portland to Ontario. No one was hurt, but Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun stepped down last month. Another Boeing engineer, Sam Salapour, testified yesterday, too. He said he witnessed improper manufacturing of a different line of Boeing jets, but was ignored by his superiors.
I raised concerns internally. I was sidelined. I was told to shut up. I received physical threats.
And a previous whistleblower, John Barnett, was found dead last month of an apparent suicide after coming forward with his concerns about the manufacturing process at Boeing. Boeing leaders are denying the whistleblower allegations. They say millions of people fly safely on their planes every year. Joining me to talk about all this is Richard Abulafia. He's an aviation analyst and consultant who has worked with Boeing and its competitors in the past. Welcome.
Nice to be on. Thank you.
Okay, well, talk about the testimony yesterday. There were two hearings in the Senate in Washington, and what came out of those hearings that was particularly noteworthy to you?
Well, to be honest, you know, it's important to investigate all allegations, and God knows, yes, their culture is broken, and there's so much about the company that needs changing. Having said that, I didn't see anything new yesterday in the testimony. You know, the problems had, of course, in recent months centered on the 737 MAX. But before that, there were big 787 manufacturing concerns that culminated in the production line's suspension back in 2022, I believe. And the list of things that were a problem then were outlined again, and maybe there were some new ones, but I didn't see them. So it's important to highlight concerns, but I'm not sure what was new that was discussed yesterday.
Right. But I guess the concern being that when this door panel flew off, that was a big issue. And then, you know, some other allegations were coming forward from these whistleblowers. So you think that the manufacturing process has been shoddy for many years now?
Well, shoddy is a bit strong. I mean, at the end of the day, you've got a badly under-resourced and somewhat alienated workforce. You've got a badly under-resourced and somewhat alienated supply chain. That's a recipe for trouble. The entire culture of the company needs changing. Most jets, 99.9%, are just fine. Do some have defects, a higher number than tolerable of defects? I'm concerned about that. Yes, I am. But each aircraft, of course, is an opportunity for a mistake. You're essentially assembling a cathedral mm-hmm. with each aircraft, and you're building hundreds of them per year. That's an extraordinary achievement. However, given everything that's happened with the culture over the past, frankly, couple decades, yeah, that's a recipe for elevated concern.
Okay, we'll talk about that shift in culture and what is happening with the workers and what is happening with the suppliers on the supply chain side.
Yeah, I think the biggest shift took place. You know, people were quick to point to the McDonnell Douglas merger in 1998, and there's some truth to that, but really, it was the introduction of what you might call that General Electric Jack Welch era culture, where everything was kind of a commodity. Everything was a cost rather than a value. The workforce didn't matter. Technology didn't matter. What mattered was, you know, basically shareholder returns and finance and not a lot else. That was sometime in the mid-2000s. And, you know, obviously they made it their priority to muscle down on suppliers, on the workforce, you know, basically everything was a cost input there to be squeezed. And inevitably, in an industry like this, there are going to be ramifications from that kind of managerial thinking.
But why this obsession with competition when really the only competitor is France's Airbus?
Yeah, I don't regard it as an obsession with competition. I regard it as an obsession with returns, basically just squeezing this machine, the people, the existing programs, and of course the supply chain, in service of returning value, quote unquote, to shareholders. And you know, you look at the numbers, they ramped up from something like 20% of their operating cash flow given away in the form of dividends and buybacks around 2010, 2012, to something like 98%. I mean, it was just a giant lemon to be squeezed. So I don't think they were concerned at all about competition, only superficially, perhaps. It was all about returns. They got a hold of a revenue stream and siphoned off what they could.
And did those shareholder returns, those higher shareholder returns, then lead to higher salaries for managers and executives?
Unquestionably. Unquestionably, there was a linkage. And of course, you know, several of the people in management were actually notable non-institutional investors. So it was bad corporate governance up and down.
So where is the government oversight on this? The NTSB, the FAA, how strict are they when they are overseeing Boeing's manufacturing process?
Well, obviously, given the enormity of what's going on in terms of manufacturing and given resource levels at, you know, the government, there's just so much they can do. Obviously, they've been under the gun since the two MAX tragedies back in the last decade. And they have been exerting a bit more authority and they have been clamping down. But again, you know, you've got a giant machine, not just Boeing, but its suppliers and everything. It's tough to supervise at all levels. And that's a challenge. You also have, frankly, a persistently deregulatory environment in Washington, D.C., you know, starve the beast, you know, deregulate, which might have served a purpose in the 80s, but also might have gone too far. And so you have the bizarre spectacle of, you know, people like Senator J.D. Vance saying, hey, you know, where's the regulation that I've been trying to get rid of for the past couple of decades, you know?
Right. But can we just point out that flying is also incredibly safe? There are 45,000 flights a day in the United States. And, you know, I don't know what the statistic is, but I would say 99.9999% of them, there's no incident, right? And was there a fatal crash last year? I don't think there was a fatal crash last year. So it's a really safe way of getting around, especially when you compare, you know, driving a car. So, you know, is the fear maybe overstated when it comes to Boeing?
I think there's a certain degree of overstatement. You know, absolutely. As you say, it's the safest form of transport ever designed by people. I mean, or indeed nature. You know, I mean, there hasn't been a crash in the U.S. resulting in a fatality in over a decade. And by contrast, you know, on the nation's roads every day, a 737 full of people were killed. If you drive instead of flying, you might as well just, you know, kill yourself and be done with it, frankly. So I understand the concerns, and I voice and echo those concerns about the manufacturing processes at Boeing. But keep in mind, you know, 99.9999999% is still extremely safe. It's just we have to watch, you know, for the eventualities.
Right. So it used to be there was a saying, if it's not Boeing, I'm not going. And now you're seeing on social media, if it is Boeing, I'm not going. People are now searching when they are searching flights, searching for the kind of who manufactured the aircraft. And if it's an Airbus, they'll take it. And if it's Boeing, they won't. Is that is that realistic? Is that foolhardy? What do you think?
You know, I don't think it's that bad. You know, that is to say, again, 99.99999%. And I, again, echoing concerns, but it's, you know, your odds of nobody has been killed. Nobody, thank God, over a decade in the U.S. The two MAX tragedies were a design issue that had been dealt with. So I think there's a, on top of that, you have people who don't often distinguish between what is manufacturing and design and what is maintenance. So you see a story about a 10-year-old or 20-year-old Boeing, and it, I don't know, the landing gear breaks or something, you know, the wheels collapse on landing, some you know, unpleasant incident out there. They don't realize it's not Boeing. That's either the airline or a third-party maintenance provider that screwed up. Boeing doesn't handle those sort of sustainment issues. So there's a fair amount of excess fear, I think, into the system. But on the other hand, you know, Boeing, they got to watch out for this. They you can't become a meme stock, if you will.
Yeah. So what happens next? I guess there will be more hearings.
Well, yeah. And to be honest, I think a lot of this has to come from internal change. They very badly need a new CEO, both at the corporate level and at the commercial unit. Ideally, it would be an engineer or somebody who really is passionate about the industry or understands complex manufacturing, you know, because they haven't had that in some time. And that person or those people can begin to change a very badly damaged culture. I really think that's the best thing that can happen. I'm not sure, other than that, what these hearings are going to accomplish. There seems to be a bit of a disconnect between what's going on, what has been going on in Washington, and the practical realities, which I suppose is one of the points raised by the whistleblowers.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Richard Abulafia. He's an aviation analyst and the managing director at Aerodynamic Advisory. Coming up, why some scientists are worried the federal government is not doing enough to prevent a bird flu pandemic. Later on, we will have your weekend movie reviews. All that coming up next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The World Health Organization is raising concerns about a possible outbreak of bird flu in humans. Two people in the United States are known to have contracted it. Both survived. But looking at cases around the world over the years, it appears that bird flu may have a 50% mortality rate in humans. The two men in the U.S. were infected from cows. So that means the virus, which kills millions of birds a year, has crossed over to mammals. A World Health Organization official told reporters in Geneva today that the bird flu could evolve to spread from person to person. So how worried should we be? Joining me now is David Bunn. He managed the Avian Flu School and Poultry Health for Development Projects in Africa. Hi there.
Hi. Nice to meet you, Madeline.
Nice to meet you, too. Okay, so there is a difference between what the CDC is saying, which is, don't worry, we have this under control, versus what the World Health Organization is saying, which is, we're kind of concerned. Can you talk about the difference?
Well, I'm very concerned. I worked on bird flu for about 7 years in Africa when H5N1, which is the current form of bird flu, was going around the globe about 10, 12 years ago. And it was in outbreaks in various countries in Africa. And this virus has the potential to be very virulent. So look at COVID, about 1 in 1,000 people died. If you think of bird flu, or they called it the Spanish flu in, you know, in 1918, that killed 30 times that. So about 2 to 3% of those people that got it. And so bird flu, like I said, you know, 10 years ago when it was in Asia, it killed slightly over 50% of those who got it. So the current version of bird flu that's floating around, you know, is likely not to be nearly that hazardous for humans, but let's just say maybe it's 5% and not 50%. Well, then it's still huge. And the only way to stop it, like say if there's an outbreak, let's say, you know, it mutates, or what we call reassorts, this current version that's in dairy cattle and throughout the US. If it just mutates a little bit to where it transmits easy from human to human, then it's going to spread around the world quickly like COVID did, and it's going to be killing millions of people. Mm-hmm. So the question is, the only way to stop that is really to have a vaccine ready to go. A decade ago, a couple different vaccines were made, but they're kind of out of date. They need to be updated, but we haven't created stockpiles. So the big issue is if the federal government or the state government are really, trying to do the most they can, they would be building a stockpile of this this vaccine.
And they aren't doing that right now. Why aren't they doing that right now?
Well, I think I heard this director of the CDC talk about a week ago, and she just said, well, we're monitoring closely. And, you know, if we spend the money on that vaccine, that's, and then it will be money we don't spend on something else. And, it's just like, well, monitoring is not good enough. I mean, monitoring, fine. Okay, we'll know when it happens, and then we'll watch it spread rapidly and kill people. So that's not the way to deal with it. Look at the impact globally in our economy and on human lives that COVID had. The cost of letting that occur is huge. So the cost of maintaining a stockpile is minute compared to that.
Can you talk about how it's transmitted? So people in the past got it, I guess, from handling birds. Do we know if it's spread from surface to surface or through the air?
Well, we used to say it can vary depending on the nature of the virus, the version that's really it's spreading from human to human. We usually say, does it spread by droplet? And so therefore, it's not going to spread across, say, more than 3 feet from person to person. Or it can be slightly more aerosol, like your typical seasonal flu, which actually, you can be in the same room and pick it up. So it depends on, the actual final form of virus that's being floated around. But no, you don't have to. It could be you'd have to touch a droplet, or it could be you could pick it up through aerosol. But, it depends on a particular virus.
And so how would it get to the point where it could spread between humans? If it's only spread right now between animals, from birds to mammals and then mammals to humans, how would it go from human to human?
Well, first of all, that's a scary jump right now where it went from birds to mammals. So mammals, obviously, a lot closer to humans. We're a mammal. So in the fact that now it's spreading cow to cow in herds, it doesn't seem like it, it's far-fetched to think that it has to mutate too much to then spread from a human to a human. And that's when it really becomes hazardous and it'd be difficult to control.
But how does it do that? How does it mutate?
Oh, well, like we experienced with COVID, as the virus is constantly mutating. I mean, it actually can change in two ways. One, it mutates, and the other is we call reassorts. And a reassort is what we're all particularly scared about. One way, for example, the way it would, change to be spread easily human to human would be the virus, say if a worker gets exposed to the bird flu, but that worker also has seasonal flu, the typical flu we get in the US every year. And those are both avian influenzas, and they actually can share genes inside a human body or inside a cow. And so then they will exchange some genetic material. And the worry is they'll get the gene in seasonal flu that spreads easy human to human attached to the bird flu virus that is very virulent, can cause, is much more deadly to humans, but now it has the gene that allows it to go easy from human to human. In other words, attach itself to human tissue, usually in the lungs.
Mm. So what are the symptoms? Are they similar to the flu?
It will be, it's usually flu-like symptoms, but it's very much respiratory. And again, the nature of each virus is a little different, and how fast your symptoms get really bad. But basically, the bad case is you're basically leaking fluid into your lungs. And one of the things about bird flu that was particularly notable is it actually killed the healthy. And what happens is the person's immune system, somebody a healthy person would overreact to it, and then the overreaction is what caused the greater damage in the lungs. So it's not like just people who are already sick or elderly or young. It's actually it can be a hazardous to very healthy people.
So kind of similar to long COVID, which is some experts are saying that is an overexpression of your immune system.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. So this all sounds scary. And I'm wondering, and you're saying the CDC is not really looking at it as the next pandemic. What about other countries? Are they taking it more seriously?
Well, I told you that honestly, I haven't been following what's going on in other countries specifically lately. I've been actually working mostly at the state level in California. So when COVID first came out, literally the February when it arrived in the US, I had worked on I'd worked on bird flu a decade earlier, and I immediately wrote a policy for the state to adopt to have the state agencies and private agencies and universities, collaborate more effectively to deal with things like COVID and the next pandemics. Unfortunately, what I discovered is we all learned is that COVID and pandemic and vaccine got highly politicized, which in the past is not something that usually occurred. It was usually people of all parties looked to the scientists. And so what that meant is when I talk to legislators now, it doesn't matter what party they're in, they don't want to touch the word pandemic with at all. They don't want to deal with that, the issue of vaccines at all. And that's quite different. I've worked in the policy arena for a long time, and usually when you have a disaster, you usually have several years where a lot of positive change could occur in policy because everybody goes, "Oh my God, we had a disaster. We need to get ready for the next and fix the policy that allows us to deal with the next emergency better." That has not happened with pandemics and after the fallout from COVID. Instead, nobody wants to even talk about it. And so we have I would say, besides the United States, we have all this technical expertise. We should do a quite a good job. We actually turned out to be one of the worst performing countries in the world dealing with COVID. And so really what we have is we have a political problem. We have the public's not prepared to deal with it, and that we need a public engagement effort to talk about it in much more detail so people understand what these things are and how we can solve it. But I don't have any higher expectation of how we'll deal with the next pandemic in the United States in the near term.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of people are fatigued from the last one. They don't even want to think of putting masks on again. So,
Correct.
how do you get the public to take this seriously?
I don't know the answer to that. I do think there needs to be some way that there's some kind of public engagement and talk. I mean, it should be the conversation be just about disease outbreaks generally. It may not be the next pandemic, but it might be there's other outbreaks that occur and we would have similar local strategies. It may not be spreading around the globe, but we're not, we have the expertise, we have the knowledge to deal with these things effectively, but we're not applying all that knowledge nor all the resources. So, for example, a pandemic is such a big deal. Even the state and federal agencies are overwhelmed. They don't have the capacity to actually do what we call, for example, surveillance for early detection. Well, actually, UC Davis, UCLA, Stanford, all their medical schools and research institutions have the capability to do surveillance and test and very quickly. And yet they weren't tapped into on COVID effectively. But that needs to happen in the future. We need to get the public. Universities and private institutions all working together to have an effective response. But that's a policy change that needs to occur in terms of how the state and federal agencies deal with this.
All right. David Bunn, who is a consultant and he managed the Avian Flu School and Poultry Health for Development Projects in Africa. David, thank you.
You're welcome.
Monday on Press Play, we will talk with the rapper Eric the Architect about his new album, and our legal eagle will be here to analyze a Supreme Court case that could change how cities deal with homelessness. So that's on Monday's show. Coming up on this show, we'll have your weekend film reviews.
I think the filmmakers use more corn syrup than at a Coca-Cola bottling plant. Is it entertaining? Yes. Is it completely stupid? Yes. Is it scary? Somewhat.
Is it next? Yes, on Press Play. You're listening to 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Time now for your weekend film reviews, including an unauthorized queer superhero parody that almost never made it to theaters. We'll have more on that controversy later. Here now is Christy Lemire, film critic for RogerEbert.com and co-host of the YouTube channel Breakfast All Day. And Sean Edwards is film critic for Fox TV in Kansas City and co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association. Hello, both of you.
Hi.
Hello, how are you?
Great. Okay, let us start with a new vampire horror film. It's called Abigail, and it follows a group of kidnappers that takes kids for ransom, and it's based on the 1966 film Dracula's Daughter.
So whose kid is she?
A very wealthy man who's about to be $50 million poorer.
Do you know what a pinky promises? If you behave and do as we say... Like Pinky promise you, it'll all be over soon.
Joey?
Yeah?
I'm sorry about what's gonna happen to you.
Yeesh, Sean. Okay, so then the child becomes the monster. Every parent knows that when that happens. So tell us more about this movie.
Well, I will say this first. It's loosely based on Dracula's Daughter, the way that New Coke was loosely based off the original Coke. The premise on the surface, I can see why this movie got greenlit. The premise on the surface is there, but the filmmakers do very little with anything, especially the ballet, because they really only use the ballet like to enhance her fighting style during the set pieces, but nothing more than that happens. I mean, this movie is basically designed to scare teens and mostly appeal to people who haven't seen very many movies because... It's all pretty much like stereotypical stuff you see in horror movies. They really don't enhance any of the horror tropes. The one thing that is fun about the movie is when the action starts, it is pretty cool. And there is more blood used in this movie than plot. I mean, actually lots of blood. I think the filmmakers use more corn syrup than at a Coca-Cola bottling plant. I mean, it's everywhere. Is it entertaining? Yes. Is it completely stupid? Yes. Is it scary? Somewhat. But the scariest thing is actually how well the movie works, despite being a super weak narrative and delivering nothing that you haven't seen before.
Christy, one more question. Is it worth seeing?
I mean, it's really fun. And there are moments in this movie that you're probably going to want to see with other people because they're just so insane. There's a thing that happens. I don't want to say what it is because when it happens the first time, it's like, whoa, what did I just see? And then they do it again. And then they do it again. And so that's sort of indicative of how the whole film flows. Like things that seem novel and cool eventually grow tiresome and repetitive. It has some cool... camera work off the top. The title sequence uses Swan Lake and her ballet performance to really knowingly over the top melodramatic effect. But it's so much like these filmmakers' previous film, Ready or Not. This is a very similar structure. So you've kind of already seen this before. But I had fun for a while.
What's with ballet being evil? From the red shoes to Black Swan to this? Ballet can't
always.
Get a break.
It's beautiful and terrifying.
Oh, ballet is always evil.
All right, next up, we have a new action comedy film from director Guy Ritchie. It's called The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. It's based on the real story of a group of British soldiers that conducted espionage in Germany during World War II. And here's a bit from the trailer.
If I'm to do this, I'll need my own team. You won't like them. They're all mad.
They'll need to be.
This is an unsanctioned, unauthorized mission. If we fail, England will be condemned to a lifetime under the German boot.
All right, Christy, this stars Henry Cavill and I guess Queen as well, even though Queen wasn't around during World War II. What did you think?
So this is a weirdly sedate Guy Ritchie movie. Everything about this would seem to cry out that this is Guy Ritchie's oeuvre. It's like fantastic looking men and they're wisecracking and they have this extremely violent mission that they have to go on. But compared to the best examples of this kind of movie that he's made in the past, going all the way back to Snatch or Rock and Rolla, this feels like the pacing is just always a little off, and the banter is never as snappy as everyone involved seems to think it is. And it's a lot of just like hunky guys sitting around in cozy sweaters on a boat, but there's just something off all the time. And then the violence is incredibly brutal and blunt and quick. And it's like the shifting of gears is always kind of unsettling, and it's never as engaging as it should be. A lot of it takes place in this port city off the coast of Africa, West Africa. And I'm not even sure that they create a particularly vivid sense of place all the time. But this is supposedly the origin story of James Bond, because among the people who are involved in this scheme and the British side of things is Ian Fleming. And supposedly he created the James Bond character on the actual guy, Gus March Phillips, who Henry Cavill plays. So it just feels like a missed opportunity.
Well, Guy Ritchie, need we say more? He's known for brutal, blunt, and quick, violent movies. Sean, what did you think?
I just felt like this entire thing was Guy Ritchie wanting to make his version of Inglourious Basterds. I mean, it is fun. It's a lot of fun. Great team of actors. And it is amusing at times. Its biggest problem is it lacks genuine depth. It has zero character development. It's basically another Guy Ritchie team on a mission caper. I mean, you know what you're going to get when Guy Ritchie directs a film. Sadly, he seems like he's sort of like repeating himself. He's in repetitive mode. So he's not delivering anything new or different. And this isn't as good as some of his previous work.
The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare in wide release today. Moving on now to an indie film. It's called We Grown Now, and it follows two best friends named Eric and Malik, who are growing up in a Chicago public housing project in the 1990s.
Me and Eric, we've done everything together since we were born.
You got dreams? Sometimes.
You ever had a dream that felt so real you thought you was awake?
You know, we always wanted better. That's why we came here.
Now how am I supposed to keep you safe?
Okay, Sean, I have to admit, I was tearing up at the trailer. So is the rest of the movie, the whole movie, as emotional as the trailer?
100%. I was going to mention, I was not only tearing up during the trailer, I teared up several times during the entire film. I will need a moment to talk about this film because I was completely blown away by every aspect of this film. About two young friends, two Black boys who were growing up in Chicago. They're looking to escape the mundaneness of school, the hardships of growing up in public housing. They live in the notorious Cabrini-Green public housing, which has been mentioned several times in the realm of pop culture. It was the public housing unit featured in Good Times. It was a public housing unit featured in Cooley High and even Candyman. They soon find that, you know, there's some challenges they have to deal with as young kids after a tragedy happens in their community. And I will say the one thing about this film, which is beautifully and brilliantly directed by Minhal Bage, is that loss and anguish has rarely been this moving and beautiful. I mean, not just the look of the film, but the meaning behind everything that happens as we examine these two young boys who are growing up in this housing project. And the thing that I really loved about this film is it's void of stereotypes and it's void of racial tropes. The dialogue is so authentic. It beautifully and smartly deals with the effects of crime and violence and death and presents this unique observations on religion while also presenting the grim realities of these two young boys, you know, dealing with, you know, what happens when you die, what happens to you when you witness this sort of things that happen to people your same age. There's also this strong subplot that deals with sort of trying to obtain the false narrative of the American dream. And it's a beautiful portrait of Black life in a grim urban environment that you rarely ever see that delivers heart. It's done at such a high intellectual level that I've never really seen anything like this done before. And there've been other filmmakers that have attempted to tell these types of stories, but none of them to this effect.
So, Christy, this is the third film from Minhal Baig, and she's worked as a TV writer on shows like Rami and BoJack Horseman. How did she do here?
Oh, it's a gorgeous film. It's visual poetry. I totally agree with everything that Sean just said. It was a big Spirit Award nominee this past year. It was up for Best Feature, Best Cinematography, and Editing. And there's so much gorgeous craft on display here. We heard a little piece of that score, too, from Jay Wadley, which is propulsive and like it's very cello and string heavy. And it really encapsulates kind of the constant state of flux that these kids are in and the wonder, but also the danger that they find themselves in. Both the kids are excellent. I want to mention their names. Blake Cameron James plays Malik and John Knight Ramirez plays Eric. And their friendship feels so true. And the authenticity of the adventures they get themselves into. There's a very sweet little Ferris Bueller's Day Off homage in the middle of it, which I enjoyed very much. But they don't feel like precocious kids. They feel totally authentic at all times. And the way that Minhal Baig depicts their daily life is in the most gorgeous slow motion or in like a reflection of these kids in a puddle on the ground, or you can like a TV gets rolled into their classroom to show them something and you see the reflection in there. And there's just real care with innovative ways of depicting their daily existence. And the adults are all great in it too. So yes, very much a must see. It's beautiful.
We Grow Now in limited release today. Finally, we have a superhero parody. It's called The People's Joker, and it was created by and stars the trans filmmaker Vera Drew. In it, she reimagines the story of the Joker as a trans coming-of-age story, and the comedians Maria Bamford and Bob Odenkirk are in this, starring and in supporting roles. And here's a bit from the trailer.
Gotham City is nothing but neon biker gangs, leather freaks, and cross-dressers. Is that what you want? Come home!
No, I won't, Mom. I'm gonna be a comedian! When I look back on my life, before going Jokeman to Harlequin, so to speak, I wasn't even sure I existed. It's like blurry, cracked mosaic of all these gender revelations.
You mean she's a he?
Okay, Christy, this premiered at Toronto back in 2022, but there was a big problem because Warner said, hey, we own Batman's IP and this was not authorized. And so I guess they threatened to sue. What happened?
So they came to this amicable conclusion, right? And Vera Drew very cheekily refers to that in the very beginning of the film. It's a whole big, long full screen where she's like, this is protected under fair use and da 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 da. And I'm so glad that that's the way that it shook out, because this movie is so strange and singular and original and funny, but also unexpectedly poignant, because what Vera Drew is doing here, as you mentioned, is exploring her own transgender journey, but through the prism of the Batman world. And so it's how she, as a kid growing up, felt different, knew that she didn't totally belong, but through comedy and through becoming this Joker figure, figures out who she wants to be. So it is extremely DIY in its look, and very intentionally so. Vera Drew used to work with Tim and Eric. And so if you know that whole Tim Heidecker, Eric Wareheim style, it's intentionally really rough hewn and absurdist, and it's bad green screen and just jokes that are a little off or like hold on to a beat for too long. It's just a strange world. So that's part of the look of this. But then there's a really wide array of different kinds of animation. Different people put together different parts of it in terms of like there's different kinds of animation, different kinds of puppetry. And so it's constantly alive and changing. But Vera Drew is so likable and so funny. And then by telling her own story in this way, all these deep, vulnerable truths emerge. Like from within this very artificial setting, you feel like she's bearing herself truly. And it's not going to be for everybody. It's a very odd movie, but I love the chutzpah of it all the time. And it's worth checking out. If you like Hundreds of Beavers, if this is your jam, this kind of weird movie, then you will enjoy this.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Color me intrigued. Sean, is this the best Batman film ever made?
No, I'm going to take it a step further. This may be the best comic book movie ever made, because it feels, I'm serious. It feels like how a comic book movie should be. It just has that vibe. And I will say, we need more unauthorized parodies, especially if they are as just sharp, insightful, and delightfully entertaining as The People's Joker. I mean, it is a bit schizophrenic, and it is weirdly brilliant. But I love this sort of coming of age tale that pushes the boundary of intellectual property laws and allows the filmmaker to tell their story in such a unique and authentic way. And I will say this, I would not use the strange word to describe this film, because for Gen Zers or anyone under 30, this is their world. This is how they live. They are going to connect with this film for a very long time. I have a 14 and 11-year-old. This is how they talk. This is how they think. These are the things that they're dealing with in their everyday lives. I also like the fact that Vera Drew enlisted more than 100 artists to sort of like, you know, create some of the animation, create some of the CGI work, create some of the puppetry work that really makes this stand out. It's something that you really never seen before. It was like an entire army of Comic-Con soldiers were enlisted to help put this film together, and it gives it such a unique look and a unique feel. And it's way more than just a parody of self-serious superhero movies. It was actually created to denounce labels, and it does such a good job of doing that. This is one of those films you'll want to revisit several times because there's so much going on. It demands multiple viewings. But I love brave maverick filmmaking, because Vera, she swung for the fences and she hit a home run with this. But I think this is going to be a generational classic that people will examine for a really long time.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I'm sold. The People's Joker in limited release now. Sean Edwards, film critic for Fox TV in Kansas City and co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association. Christy Lemire, film critic for RogerEbert.com and co-host of the YouTube channel Breakfast All Day. Thank you both.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, Evan Kleinman is here to talk about the Passover plate, one dish in particular, haroset. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Passover begins this Monday at sundown. And of course, there will be the traditional foods like gefilte fish, brisket, and matzo ball soup. And one element of the Seder plate, Evan Kleinman says, makes a great canvas for self-expression is the haroset. Evan, what is it?
So it's most often a melange of dried and or fresh fruits and nuts that are chopped or ground into a paste. I would say that the haroset most American Jews of Ashkenazi descent make is with apples, walnuts, honey, and wine, maybe with a little cinnamon. They're all chopped together to resemble a paste. Our conversation will go beyond the apple.
Okay, good. And of course, as everything does when it comes to Passover, it symbolizes something.
Yeah, it's interesting. All the elements of the Seder plate, all the food elements of the Seder plate are meant to lead you along to tell the story. The most prevalent story of the paste meaning is that it represents the mortar Jews who were enslaved in Egypt used in building Pharaoh's buildings. What's amazing about it is the custom of eating haroset is so old, with evidence that it dates to 200 in the Common Era, 200 CE.
Wow, incredible. Okay, so you are going to talk about some non-Eastern European preparations of haroset.
Yeah, I've chosen three examples of haroset from three different traditions. One is Persian, one is a Yemenite-Moroccan family mashup, and the one I make, which is a borrowed tradition with Sephardi Turkish roots.
Okay, let's begin with the Persian version. How different is it from the Eastern European apple-based one?
Well, not that different, and I kind of like it because it's kind of like a bridge. This recipe I'm highlighting is from a woman who came from Iran to Rhode Island, moved to New York, and is now living in Mexico. Her name is Eddie, and she shared her recipe with the Jewish Food Society, which is a group that archives family recipes from the diaspora. What I like about this recipe is that she uses the familiar apples, but she adds pears, which adds a different level of sweetness and texture. She also uses dates and bananas, which was new
for me. Bananas?
Yeah, and you know, they're a lot of people use bananas, which is just amazing to me. She also, of course, adds a mixture of nuts, walnuts, pecans, and pistachios, which I also love because they each have such distinct flavors. And she adds a bit of wine, and her direction is to form a thick, coarse paste that still maintains some crunch.
Mm. Okay, and it sounds like it's vegan, too.
Yeah, she's not using any honey. Maybe the banana mm-hmm. is a substitute for honey.
Ah, yeah, okay. That makes sense. Okay, so you have another one from a cookbook called The Jewish Holiday Table. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, this cookbook is a production of the Jewish Food Society. It's really a fabulous cookbook. It's brand new. And this Yemenite-Moroccan mashup haroset comes from a woman named Rinat Zadok. And it's in this new book, which is filled with stories and recipes from families all over the world. Her recipe features walnuts, almonds, hazelnuts, which I really love, and sesame seeds, along with medjool dates, wine, honey, cinnamon, and cardamom. And like many haroset recipes, she relies on the food processor to grind the ingredients. But she makes this one move, which I think is really smart. She soaks the dates in hot water first, which makes it easier. If you've ever tried to process dates, that might be a little dry in the food processor. It can be very frustrating. Mm.
Oh, for sure.
And then she shapes this mixture into little 1-inch balls for serving, which is a nice touch.
Oh, okay. So almost like a rum ball, kind of.
Yeah.
Like dessert, which I like.
Dessert. And if you have leftovers, it would be so easy to just pop them between two little pieces of dough to make like a little hand pie or something.
Well, or matzah, I guess.
Well, after the holiday. I always have way too much.
Okay, and last up, we have one that you use personally, and it's Sephardic Turkish.
Right. So this is a haroset I started making years and years ago when a woman I worked with, Victoria Granoff, who is now one of the most talented food creatives in the country, taught me. Her family are Sephardic from Turkey, and recipes she shared with me have been the source of much culinary inspiration for me. So the thing that's different about this haroset is in addition to all the dried fruit, I use dates, dried apricots, golden raisins, sometimes dried figs. I also use fresh whole oranges, including the peel. And then for nuts, I add pistachios. Sometimes I'll add wine or pomegranate juice, cinnamon, ground coriander, and a little hint of cayenne. But I choose to grind my ingredients in a grinder. I have one that attaches to my stand mixer. I prefer the texture, and I find making it much easier. The orange are cut up in pieces, and they just flow through the grinder. And the use of that whole fruit, of the whole orange, including peel and juice, it just adds another layer to the mixture, and it really counteracts the cloying sweetness of the dried fruits.
And that's really interesting because I thought the horseradish was supposed to do that, but you could actually do that internally with the haroset, is combat its own sweetness with itself.
So yeah, horseradish being the bitter herb that is part of the Seder plate and a big part of the meal as a condiment. Yeah, I mean, it's still plenty sweet, but I just really love how the orange peel kind of brings the sweetness back a little bit. And also when you're trying to turn all of these dried fruits into a paste, the orange juice lends this welcome amount of juice, so you don't have to use so much wine if you don't want to.
Okay. Well, as you do, I'm sure you can put your own spin on any of these recipes and add all kinds of spices, right? And maybe even something like tahini?
I mean, I think that's the whole thing about haroset, is that it's linked to place and family, most of all. And I think it really is a fun canvas to play with. You know, sesame is considered to be kitniot, which means legumes, and in some traditions are not fit for Passover. I think tahini might be a stretch, even though the seeds are used by some Sephardic cooks and Mizrahi Jews. I think adding candied ginger to the mix would be spectacular.
Oh, that sounds delicious. Okay. Wow, I can't believe we did a whole segment on just one ingredient, one item on the Seder plate. We didn't even get into a lamb shank or the horseradish or the salty water, any of it. Just that.
This is the most delicious part of the Seder plate.
Yeah, that's for sure. The rest, ah. I get the symbolism, but you know.
Yeah.
All right. You'll have links to the recipes we discussed up at KCRW.com. And a reminder, a gentle reminder, there is still time to RSVP for KCRW's Good Food Pie Fest at KCRW.com/pie. Pie Fest is on April 28th this year, so do not miss out on that. Evan Kleinman is the host of KCRW's Good Food. You can listen every Saturday morning at 10. And what's on your show this week, Evan?
I interviewed Carla Vasquez, who wrote a cookbook called Salvi Sol. It's the first cookbook about the cuisine of El Salvador in English, if you can believe that. Amazing. And Nicole Rucker, famed pie maker, drops a lot of knowledge about making apple pie.
Ah, speaking of apples. All right, Evan, thank you so much. And happy Passover.
Happy Passover to you as well.
And that does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Brian Hartzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, and Zeke Reed. Ted Robbins line edited this week. Amy Ta is our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Our technical director is, of course, the Super Mario Saavedra. Today's engineer was the Super Mike Stark. And that will do it for us this week. Come right here back again tomorrow for KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. They'll talk about anti-Semitism on college campuses. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend. I'll be back with you again on Monday.